Good morning, all. My name is Nathaniel Cheney, although I tend to go by as Nate. And I'm actually a land surface modeler. I'm a hydrologic modeler. And it's great to see friends here and colleagues that I've chatted with previously. And today is an extension about this work on Polaris. So as a hydrologic modeler, I'm interested in this problem of moving towards high spatial resolution in modeling. So Christine previously talked about how the land surface modeling community is getting down to the field scale landscape and that we're almost there. And I actually am going to say that we actually are there. And so this is the motivation for me for the development of Polaris. It's just that we need this information. So before I start talking about Polaris, I think it's a great thing of having 30 minutes for this talk. I actually want to give some background of our interest in high resolution soil information in land models. So we think about land surface models, we can think about applications. And so classic applications of land surface models is numerical weather prediction, so weather forecasting. If you want to get, for example, convection right, you need to account for the coupling between the land and the atmosphere. So they both need to talk to each other. And so you have to account for these surface fluxes. So to get these surface fluxes, you need to be able to model land surface processes. So that's one case. So this is, you can think about 1 to 2 weeks out in prediction. Another one, climate models, Earth system models. The concept of the Earth system model means you're coupling atmosphere, ocean, land, cryosphere, and you're really trying to see how the Earth system evolves as a unit. And you can think about, from a land perspective, think about biogeochemical cycles, hydrology, energy cycles, etc. And so you need to be able to really get those land surface processes. And also from an application perspective, let's say, for example, that we have rainfall information, satellite rainfall, we have meteorology, but we don't really have estimate of soil moisture, stream flow, etc. So another application of land surface modeling can be cases such as flood and drought monitoring, so you run it in real time with satellite information. So that is the background for land surface models, for global scale land surface models. But I want to talk about, for a second, before I talk about the soils, is this concept of spatial scale. So these land surface models, and Christine talked about this, normally we run them at, well, you can think about a 100 by 100 kilometer grid scale. So here is actually zooming out into the Bay Area in Northern California, where this is really what a 100 by 100 kilometer grid cell looks like. And if you just zoom in and you look at the amount of heterogeneity and information that's there, it's pretty amazing. If we take this a step further and we zoom in, what we see is within this one grid cell in our model, right, we have a delta, we have farmland, we have mountainous areas, and we have urban systems. And so what our model is trying to do is take all of this heterogeneity, summarize it, and then be able to do something that's computationally efficient to then couple to the atmosphere. And so it's a really significant challenge. But even at these scales, up here, there is already a lot of heterogeneity. But the fascinating part, and I come at this also from a hydrologist perspective, is that a lot of the processes that are really controlling our land surface processes, so surface fluxes, et cetera, are really happening at that field scale to landscape scale. So here's an example of very small catchments where the runoff is being generated. Here's an example of this patchwork of farms, complex stream networks, urban systems, so you're going to have the urban canopy, streets, vegetation, lakes, etc. And one of my favorites is the concept of a riparian zone. A riparian zone where you have water converging due to topography, and due to that water being closer to the surface, then you're going to have more vegetation in the areas of high topographic convergence. So there's a massive amount of heterogeneity, and we think about the macro scale land surface processes, we can't disregard what's happening at that fine scale. So does it actually matter? Does fine scale matter for the macro scale? So here are three examples that I pulled up. This one's in Tombstone, Arizona, specifically at evapotranspiration, latent heat. And here is latent heat calculated from Landsat. So this is 100 meters. And you can clearly see the riparian zone. So you see that you have more water in the riparian zone, therefore you're going to have higher evaporation. When you take the MODIS at 1 kilometer, when you lose that information, that 100-meter information, you effectively lose that amount of heterogeneity. From a hill slope perspective, with soils heterogeneity and topographic heterogeneity along a hill slope, this is a case study in Northwest Florida, where just simply by this fine scale heterogeneity, you already have differentiation in oak species. So think about biodiversity within macro scale land surface models. And if you're disregarding that fine scale heterogeneity when you're trying to account for something by biodiversity, you will not be able to accomplish it. And more classically in hydrology, this idea of a runoff generation mechanism. So you have a hill slope, and your heterogeneity in topography, soils, land cover will play a role in where the runoff is being generated and how much it is being generated. So the main conclusion that I want to draw from this is that this sub 100 meter heterogeneity, this field scale to landscape heterogeneity, actually plays a fundamental role in the macro scale water, energy, and biogeochemical cycles. So in our models that we try to do 10 to 200 kilometers grid cells, we can't just disregard these processes. Now, within macro scale hydrology, land surface models, etc., we've understood this. This is not a new concept. We've known that, for example, for runoff generation, you have to be able to represent that fine scale heterogeneity. And so what we do, we take this complex heterogeneity, this fine scale heterogeneity, and we effectively create parameterizations. And the parameterizations summarize this information. I'm not going to go too much into detail about this because I want to talk about the soils. But the basic idea is, say for example you have land cover maps, high resolution. What you do is you compute a statistical distribution. And with those bins, we call them tiles. And so you know that your macro scale grid cell is covered by, say, 30% forest, 20% croplands, etc. So you have those different surface fluxes that are occurring for those tiles. And so this is what we then use in these land surface models that have a spatial resolution between this 1/8 to 2 degrees, so 10 to 200 kilometers. And I could talk about this for 20, 30 minutes by itself. In reality, this is my main area of research in terms of increasing the resolution in our land surface models. But there's a challenge with how we think about heterogeneity. As we think about Earth system models, we are moving to more formally coupling the land, energy, and biogeochemical cycles. But how we think about heterogeneity in our models and how we've done this for the past decades, they really cannot capture these complex interactions. So there's a current effort that's ongoing to use big data and high-performance computing to rethink spatial heterogeneity in land surface models. And part of that effort is the development of new land surface models. So here are just some examples about what the land surface modeling community is now producing. So the SUMA model is Martin Clark out of NCAR. HydroVlox is a model that I developed at Princeton a couple years ago. The GFDL, they do Earth system modeling, and they have explicit representations of hill slopes with soil heterogeneity and topographic heterogeneity within the macro scale. And then Parflo CLM, Reed Maxwell out in Colorado, they couple the CLM vertical land surface model with a fully resolved three-dimensional groundwater model. And the scales at which we are doing this, these models are run anywhere from 10 meters to 1 kilometer. And these are meant for macro scale applications. So this is meant for continental to global scale. So really this is where we're moving in terms of land surface modeling to really bring it down to that field scale landscape problem. So there's this emerging new paradigm in land surface modeling where land surface models are aiming to explicitly resolve at these scales between 10 to 1,000 meters, given that we know the role that fine scale heterogeneity can play at the macro scale. So that is my background and my interest in soils. And let me explain why. So here is a chart, this is by Wade Crowe in 2012, where he shows the drives of spatial heterogeneity of soil moisture. And when you think about soil moisture, what drives what you can see out in the field of that heterogeneity? And you think about meteorology, land cover heterogeneity, topography, and soils. And so what they do here is going from point scale to continental scale, they really define a range that matters to define that spatial heterogeneity. So when you think about soil moisture, meteorology, so here you have, this is field scale, watershed scale, and regional scale. Sorry for it's so small. But the main idea is that for meteorology, you get slightly above the watershed, up to the regional, is really where it matters. For land cover heterogeneity, between field scale to watershed and up and above, getting coarser is what matters for that heterogeneity. For topography, you are really getting down to the field scale. But for soils, and you know this definitely more than I do, you really need to be getting down to that point scale, field scale, watershed scale if you want to capture that heterogeneity. And so if we're going to be able to capture the heterogeneity appropriately of soil moisture, we want to make sure that the information that we're providing to these models is as far left to these ranges as possible. So we're capturing that fine scale heterogeneity and the impact that has on the processes. So what information do we have to parameterize our models with? So for meteorology over the U.S., we have stage 4 radar rainfall, which is a roughly 4 kilometer. And when you're mainly interested in the heterogeneity of soil moisture, this definitely is sufficient. And it puts us at the scale between field scale to watershed scale. So we're happy with that. For land cover, as an example, we have the National Land Cover Database, which is a 30-meter derived from Landsat. And in this framework, that also puts us to the left. So we feel that we're able to capture the heterogeneity of land information, of land cover information. For elevation, we have the National Elevation Dataset, 30 meters, you can actually get it 10 meters, and that also puts us to the left of that range. But what about soils? So in continental scale hydrology over the contiguous United States, we've been using for the past 20 years this CONUS soil product, which is derived from Statsco. So you can think about roughly a 25 kilometer product. And if we put that in this range here, we are far coarser than when we think about the heterogeneity of soils. And so we are missing a lot of information about that heterogeneity. And so that is really the motivation behind my interest in soils, is we need to be able to provide information to really capture that heterogeneity of the system. And I'm not talking about just simply horizontal spatial heterogeneity, I'm also talking about vertical heterogeneity. As Christine pointed out, can actually play a very important role. So what do we have existing continental soil data? So when you look at globally over CONUS, as I said, we've got the CONUS soil product. But until recently, we were still relying in these global scale models on the Harmonized World Soil Database, which is a roughly 500 kilometer product. So then you think about the amount of information that we are not capturing with these models. So is there anything out there? When I was a PhD student, I think it was about 5 years ago when I was working with some colleagues and they introduced me to Serco. To this day, I'm still blown away by the amount of information that's in there. So Serco is 100 plus years of soil surveys. You can think about an effective spatial resolution of 1,000 meters, and that definitely varies depending on where you're at, with 20,000 plus soil series over CONUS. And for each soil series, you have these vertical profiles of information for different properties. And compared to what we're currently using in our models, this is leaps and bounds better, right? And for that reason, I've always been extremely excited about using Serco. But why can't we just directly use it in our macroscale models? So the biggest challenge has to do with the coming mapping issues. So you have spatial discontinuities. So this is a classical example here in Mississippi, where due to bias from the surveyor, you're going to have different counties have different soil series that are mapped. Variable spatial resolution depending on where you are on the, in the continent, and simply areas that are unsurveyed. Now, from a modeling perspective, especially these two, especially unsurveyed areas, are pretty much a non-starter because you need information, right? You need to have an actual prediction of what the soils are at that place. And so to use Serco, you have to really address these problems. And so that was the motivation for Polaris. So Polaris, which I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk, is a 30-meter map of soil map of the contiguous United States. And it started off with the soil series map, and now we've moved on to also producing the property maps. And this is most of what I'm going to talk today is a paper that came out in Geoderma earlier this year. And the basis is on digital soil mapping. So we know that soils, where the soils are in space, can be related to a set of environmental covariates, such as climate, organisms, relief, parent material, age, and position. And you can create a nonlinear relationship to then estimate the position of soils. So to do this, we want to be able to take Sergo, and we want to be able to relate Sergo to environmental covariates, and then predict so that we can deal with these issues that are currently available in Sergo, so we can create something that can be directly then used for our models. So here's an example of environmental information that we use to create Polaris. So the USGS National Elevation Dataset, which I talked about previously, the USGS Gamma Air Radium Metric, which is a proxy, you think of geology, and then products derived from Landsat, so the web-enabled Landsat, and the National Land Cover Database, among others. And so the basic idea behind developing Polaris is a DSMART HPC algorithm where you effectively divide the contiguous United States into overlapping blocks. And with each of those blocks, you come along, you sample from Sergo from the Sol series. In this case, we did 50,000 samples per target plus buffer. And then you also sample the same locations for the environmental covariates. And then in this case, we then fit a random forest, so a machine learning algorithm, to count for the nonlinearities. And then using that random forest, we're then able to make predictions. The really cool thing about random forests and many machine learning algorithms is you're not just simply providing a deterministic estimate. You're actually providing the probabilities of getting pretty much any of the soil series that can pretty much fall into the soil and the environmental covariate information. And so you can actually come up with soil series maps. You can think about this probability ranked. So the outcome of this project was this idea of remapping Sergo for the explicit reason of creating a product which can then be used for environmental models, such as land surface modeling. And so there's this schematic. You take Sergo, you take the environmental covariates, you apply DSMART HPC, and then Polaris, the Sol series maps of Polaris, for each 30-meter grid cell, we provide the 50 most probable soil series with the associated probabilities. And if we just look at the original challenges that I was discussing about Sergo, here's this county boundary issue. Really what's happening here is we're learning the relationships, and because this county effectively is an outlier, this discontinuity effectively is removed. And in unsurveyed areas, you're learning the relationship in the surrounding region, and then you're making a prediction. Now, that's the first part of Polaris, and this is work that was done a year and a half ago. But the challenge that we have, especially within land surface models, is you can't just supply soil series maps to these models. You actually need to provide property maps. So how do we go from soil series maps to property maps that can be directly then fed into our models? And that's what I want to talk about for the rest of the talk. So the next part of this project has been to take Polaris, and so for each 30-meter grid cell, you have the probabilities of the 10 most probable soil series per grid cell. And then we also take the soil series that are available in Sergo for all the different variables that are available that would be of importance to land surface modeling. And we harmonize them from 0 to 200 centimeters. And we provide then, using the triangular distribution information that's in Sergo, and we know that for a soil series, you have multiple components that fall within that soil series. We then are able to create a distribution, in this case a beta distribution, for each layer, each variable, for these 20,000 plus soil series profiles. And so we combine this information using an algorithm called Proper HPC to then create these 30-meter maps of these properties over the contiguous United States, from 0 to 5 centimeters all the way down to 100 to 200 centimeters. And now it does not want to change. There we go. So here's an example. This is too much memory. There we go. So here's an example of map Sergo properties. So this is, once again, I have the Sergo properties. I've created these harmonized soil profiles. I take Polaris, the soil series from Polaris, and then I effectively map the Sergo properties. And so this is the top layer for a suite of variables that would be of interest to land surface models. So available water content, saturated soil water content, field capacity, wilting point, saturated hydraulic conductivity, organic matter, pH, depth to restrictive layer, sand, silt, clay, and bulk density. Now, all of these, except for the depth to restrictive layer, you're going to have information that has multiple layers. Obviously, for depth to restrictive layer, you just have a single layer that's giving us the depth to that layer. However, for land surface models, we need more than just map properties. We actually need, for example, the parameters for the water retention curves. So in land surface models, most still use Brooks Corey, some, but we are definitely moving on to Van Genuchten. So to be able to provide a product from Polaris to be actually able to use it in these models, we then take a set of petit transfer functions, which my colleagues out in the University of Sydney helped me develop a couple months ago. And we then just map residual soil water content, bubbling pressure, lambda, as well as all the parameters that we need for Van Genuchten. Now, I haven't talked too much about at this point, but there is massive amount of uncertainty that we're going to have in Polaris. If you simply look at the mapping of the soil series and you look at each 30-meter grid cell, in many cases you can have the top five most probable that can have very similar probabilities, meaning either the environmental information that we're using is not sufficient to constrain it, or simply how we're doing the estimation is not enough. So there is going to be uncertainty associated with the soil series mapping, and also the uncertainty associated with the actual harmonized soil profiles. To account for this information, we're not just providing a deterministic mean, we're actually harnessing all of that uncertainty and then providing what you can think about as a distribution. So for each 30-meter grid cell, for each variable, for each layer, we're giving the minimum, the maximum, the mean, the variance, and also all the parameters you need to think about for a beta distribution. Now, in hydrology and land surface modeling, we understand that uncertainty is there, and there's no way we're going to get around that. So, but instead of just running away from it, what we do is we think about calibration exercises, etc. Normally, when we've done calibration in land surface models and hydrologic models, we use a global range. So, for example, for bubbling pressure, we just use a range that's pretty much used for everywhere, and then we just calibrate based on that. What Polaris lets you do is really rethink that a bit. For a 30-meter grid cell, based on all the information that I have, I actually now have uncertainty bounds. And so when I think about the calibration, it's much more constrained. So I know if my physical parameters that I'm estimating using the calibration actually fall into what you think you could find at that point. And so this is for sand, silt, and clay. Then last, just simply taking the map properties and comparing them to Sergo. So here's the map properties for porosity for the top layer, clay, saturated hydraulic conductivity. And you can see the missing areas, and in places like in Ohio, where you see these artificial discontinuities, which we want to be able to remove. And so by removing that and then mapping the properties, you see that removes, and then we're able to gap fill those regions. And from at least from a visual perspective, you can see that they are in fairly close agreement. If I actually looked at when you upscale to 1 kilometer and look at the linear correlation, you're looking around 0.8 for the actual map properties. So we feel confident that, at least from a regional perspective, we are capturing the general features. However, there is definitely a large amount of uncertainty if you really go down to 30 meters still. So, as I move to finish up the talk, I want to go back to this data for the new generation of land surface models. So we have all these land surface models are now being created that can harness this field scale to landscape information. And we've been in this paradigm for the past 2 decades, where we have this type of information at high resolution, but we just don't have the soil information for that. What Polaris is trying to do is shift that paradigm and bring the soil information down to the field scale. And now bringing this back to my primary research, which is actually land surface modeling itself, what we've done is a proof of concept using this model that I developed a couple years ago, which is this field scale resolving model, is taking all this environmental data, meteorology, land cover, topography, and now using Polaris using a land surface model we called HydroBlox, and then producing 30-meter simulations over the entire contiguous United States between 2004 and 2014. And so here I'm showing some examples of the simulations for soil moisture, sensible heat, snow water equivalent, and latent heat. And just to try to convey the amount of information that this type of modeling can now give us, is the model going to be correct? No. The model is going to have uncertainties. Do we know what the uncertainties are? Do we know how the models fail? A lot of understanding the processes has to be doing field work and understanding what the model is saying at the field scale. And we have not been able to do this with macro scale models until now. But now with Polaris, with the topography information that's available, we can now produce these continental scale simulations at 30 meters. Here I extract four USDA catchments, and then I superimpose the in-situ observations. And if you zoom in over Walnut Gulch, Little Washdown, Little River, we're doing a pretty good job. Over Reynolds Creek, you can see up here, up in Idaho, that there's something here that we're just flat out missing. It might be the soils from Polaris that are wrong, or it might be the processes that are represented. But the point that I want to get across with this is using this field scale information now in our models, we can explicitly model this information at 30 meters to be able to think about applications for these models, to rethink applications for macro scale models, and in terms of validation. Now, where am I going with this? Polaris offers an opportunity. And one of the major drivers of my interest in Polaris and in developing high-resolution information and high-resolution models, I want to understand, going back to fine-scale land surface processes, what is the role of fine-scale heterogeneity in the Earth system? When you think about the coupled Earth system, what does that fine-scale heterogeneity do? And using Polaris, using these products, and incorporating them into these new land surface models really allows us to really get at this problem. That's something that I'm actually looking at GFDLR map currently. So just to finish up, Polaris is a product over the contiguous United States at 30 meters, derived from taking Surgo, first creating the soil series property, the soil series maps, and then taking the properties and then mapping the property maps. Where for each 30-meter grid cell, we're providing the 50 most probable soil series, and then the next product then is then the map soil properties with uncertainties for the multiple vertical layers. And then for land surface models and hydrologic models, we then produce the derived data products, such as the water retention curve parameters. And the result is we can think about that improved representation of soil heterogeneity in land surface models. And with that, I'd like to thank all of my collaborators. All of this actually started 3 years ago, actually in a land surface modeling session here that Christine put together when I met Alec McBratney. And it's been really exciting to work with them and to gain from their expertise as we move forward and we continue to build the soil property maps over the U.S. And with that, thanks for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions.
That was a great talk.
Thank you.
A great product, one that we need in the Northern Rocky Mountains. Being someone from Idaho, one of the largest issues we have is that heterogeneity, particularly in topography. And I think geology might be what's driving some of these uncertainties in this region, because we can quickly go from metasedimentary to igneous to metamorphic.
Right. So I've been very fortunate to be working with people at the NRCS over the past couple of years. And as I started doing this a couple years ago and they've been giving me feedback, I've definitely been learning much more of the environmental information that you can use. And so what I'm showing here is like first property map, the soil series maps that we did. An ongoing effort is to actually revisit that and actually include a lot more information to do a better job with the predictions. So the question is, if we have the 50 most probable soil series, a lot of those might be very similar, and so how do we account for that similarity? So currently, in our original, the original paper that came out, we actually don't account for the proximity in the soil series. I think the more indirect way of getting that is actually to map soil properties. Because by actually mapping the soil properties, if there's a lot of similarity between them, then the actual map soil properties are very similar. And so what we found is there can be a lot of dissimilarity between the soil series, but actually when you actually map the soil properties, they're actually very similar. But I think there could be a more rigorous way of actually comparing the soil series given their proximity between themselves. That's definitely something that should be done. That is a very good question. I don't know exactly the reasons why. I mean, it really depends on the part of the U.S. that you're in. And it depends on the range that's available within Cervo itself for the properties. But why exactly between the different clay sand silt the ranges are so different, I don't have an answer right now. Absolutely. I smile because Travis, who I've been working with, this is one of his interests, right? And taking the actual metadata that's available within for each component, so you have like your slope and elevation, so you can actually use that to disaggregate it before you actually go out and sample from it. So I completely agree with you, and that's definitely something that we are currently looking into doing and applying to rethinking about how we do Polaris. So let me see if I understand correctly. So, for example, we might have 50,000 soil series that we actually know the latitude longitude of those soil series, correct? And can we actually merge that directly in? The argument I would say is yes, and that's something also I think we're also looking at, is can you actually create a model that gives more weight to soil series that actually you know exactly where they are versus the other ones? And so you default to doing Cervo where you really just don't have that much in terms of observations. But when you actually have those points, then you just give more weight to that information. That's something we are definitely moving towards as well.
I'll have to cut it off right there. Hate to do that, but we have to keep going. Please pay it forward after the session. Thanks again.
Thank you.